Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/FTSW. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Welcome to Air Temple Island, your new home.
Who do you think you are?
Got an idea about who I am now, chumps?
I'm the Avatar. You gotta deal with it.
You're the Avatar, and I'm an idiot.
She's the perfect messenger to tell the city of my power.
This mucko's got moxie.
Name's Bolin, by the way. Bolin's got some moves, huh?
I will make no such promises.
I once bested a man with my trusty boomerang who was able to firebend with his mind.
The morning is evil.
We shall meet again soon, beautiful woman.
I've been dying to ask you, what happened to Zuko's mom?
It is time for you to be equalized.
What?
Solution.
I can't wait to get started. Yes! Finally!
Hello and welcome to From the Spirit World, a legendary Avatar The Last Airbender and The Legend of Korra podcast for DonBlueFang.net. If you want extensive in-depth discussion on Korra from longtime knowledgeable fans of Avatar and longtime fandom members, then this is the podcast for you. I'm your main host, Dylan, and today I'm joined by Mel.
Hello.
Josh.
Hey.
Josh has not been on the podcast for a while, but he's been on before, and his DF name is I Mourn the Wicked. And I'm also joined by new mini-host, Colin.
Hello.
Colin is the airwave on DonBlueFang, and Delaney.
Hello.
And Delaney is Sergeant Nerd-at-Arms at DonBlueFang. So this is a mini-cast where we discuss a single Avatar or Korra topic for a brief period of time. This is our first minicast, so bear with us, but it shouldn't be too different. You can email us at dylan@dongwufang.net and post in the DonBlueFang forums at dongwufang.net/forums. And you can apply to get on these minicasts as well by checking out the thread in the DonBlueFang forums on it. Okay, today, this minicast, we will be discussing Amon and Tarlok's motivations at the end of Korra. Somewhat of a broad topic, but we're going to hone in on a couple of scenes, including, of course, the scene at the end, that scene with on the boat. And
I have a clarifying question. Are we going to be referring to Noatak / Shaman as one of the names for the whole time, or
if it's Amon as a kid, we'll call him Noatak, but the rest of the time I'm going to call him Amon.
Okay, good.
Yeah, because I don't know, I just still think of him as Amon, even maskless.
Yes.
So we'll hone in on that scene and then a few other things, and we'll try to figure out really what they were thinking when these important things were happening, because it's really unclear. And I think to a certain extent, there's not enough evidence to support one or the other when deciding what they were thinking. I don't think Mike and Brian gave us enough. But they gave us some stuff, and we can try to infer, even if we're going beyond the scope of what happened on the show, really. And I think we are. This is going to be, to a certain extent, speculation on our part. But I guess we'll start by reviewing the evidence here. Treating this like a crime scene, apparently. And there's a few things that we should talk about first. And the first is that Tarlok, before we get into any of his, like, secret identity stuff, was shown to persecute non-benders. Like I said on the podcast, I think on that episode emphatically, that I really thought he hated non-benders. What impression did you guys get from his supposed persecution of them?
Well, I only saw him persecuting equalists. I mean, that's what I got. He did go back and persecute non-benders after that. Okay, I thought you were talking about the other episode.
No.
I think, though, that the non-bender persecution was more of just a trap for Korra?
It could have been. I did get the impression during that scene, and we're talking about episode 8 here, that he wasn't, he was genuinely annoyed that Korra showed up. I kind of thought that.
The first time he's annoyed because Korra beats him there, then maybe he just kind of constructs this, maybe it was kind of planted in the radio for her to get her to come.
Yeah, I could see that. But at the same time, I don't know.
I just feel like that when he's going after non-benders in the general, it's just like, well, everyone's like, you have to assume all non-benders. When in his point of view, you have to assume all non-benders are equalists because, like, you never know. Like, in the scene in episode 6, they disguise themselves as just regular, like observers at the show. So, I mean, I feel like it's, like, probably what happened.
You know what it reminds me of, historically speaking, is with what Colin just said, you know, during World War II, after, you know, the Pearl Harbor was attacked, the U.S. government, you know, automatically but essentially rounded up everyone who was Japanese or of Japanese descent and put them in camps. I think it's a similar thing going on here, Tarlok is assuming that all non-benders are equalists.
Yeah. Well, remember though, that when that happened with the Japanese, there were almost no spies found. So,
obviously it's not the same thing, but it's the same paranoia is what I'm saying. Tarlok thinks the same way as the government did when that first happened, is that when you have a crisis like this, you have to assume everyone, well, you don't have to, you have to assume everyone could be an enemy until you weed out the actual enemies.
I mean, that's true, like, in every, like, guerrilla warfare instance, like, you don't know, like, who's the enemy and who's not, and that's, like, really hard. Every government has to, like, take precautions to that and just assume everyone who's not with you is against you.
So. It's because the city was at war, and that was the big thing, you know, like, I really understood that with what you said, Mel, was that's what I was thinking with the Japanese internment, with the city at war, they can't really be so cautious about it. They have to take action. Was it necessarily a good action? No, but that's how I feel like Tarlok, not necessarily just completely against non-benders, but because of the equalist movement, that he had to take action.
Yeah.
So all of this is good and all, but it's interesting because...
Thank you.
Well, no, this is a very good discussion. But then the show brings up that Tarlok apparently was just trying to, like, claim Republic City for his own. So it's not like he was genuinely trying to keep them at bay against the current government system.
Here's what confuses me the most about Tarlok is that, considering that he grew up with Amon and his father and was always the weakest among, as far as, you know, being able to bend in things, why wouldn't he identify more with those who are less powerful?
So I don't really understand his supposed hatred of non-benders, but the only explanation that makes sense presented in the show is that he doesn't hate non-benders. He just was trying to suppress the Equalist movement to gain more power, I guess, because he saw them as a threat.
And trap Korra.
Possibly. I would say that the suppressing the Equalist movement is maybe what the show is more hinting at, but again, it's not like it ever specifically stated it.
Yeah, I'm more inclined to go with suppressing the Equalist movement, just because I didn't see him really do anything in terms of Korra until she showed up, you know, in his office or the council.
Yeah, but either way, though, he's suppressing a threat to try to take over Republic City.
Well, yeah, I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, so I guess that brings, we'll probably get back to this, it brings us to our next scene, and let's throw Amon in here. We're in episode 9 now. Amon shows up at Tarlok's lodge. We talked about on this podcast, he may have been tracking him. Because how does he know about the whereabouts? How does he know about the metal cage?
Satellites.
Oh, I wish they did that.
And the Equalist movement is so extensive, it may not have had to have been Amon that was tracking him.
Yeah, it could have just been any random person. It could have been Lieutenant. But he would have screwed it up, though, and got the wrong location. So then they have a confrontation, and Amon takes Tarlok's bending away and takes him prisoner. Tarlok says, "What are you?" But based on his later statements, that doesn't have any significance, really, other than, what are you?
Yeah, it was a cool line until we found out what he was.
They kind of killed him.
It's like, oh, you're just that.
Yeah, you're just that, but also, and I guess that's next.
Well, it does serve a purpose in kind of proving to the audience that he didn't know that he was Amon was Noatak until that moment.
Because
if he doesn't give that line, then we don't know when he discovered that Amon.
Well, no, because he says specifically in episode 11 when he discovered it, and he says that at that moment he didn't know. He said, Tarlok says, When Amon took his bending away, it seemed familiar, and he later recognized it as Noatak's bloodbending grip.
I mean, I think that that line, what are you, was more to tell us that being able to resist bloodbending is not something many people can do.
Yeah.
More so than Tarlok, you know, being in shock. Well, he's in shock of it because no one, because people can't do it, and that's what it was meant to tell us.
I'm going to maybe hint at the fact that Amon is a bloodbender later, though no one caught it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was a pretty big theory, though, too, because I think people caught on to that and said, well, maybe he's some sort of bloodbender, because I think that theory was hanging around for a while, before even back when Bumi was still a really big theory, I think bloodbending was actually...
Yeah, it wasn't as prevalent, and then really after Episode 8, people, specifically Jeff, got the actual theory down.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's keep going. Let's stop here. And the significance is Amon takes his bending away, knowing full well that this is his brother. This is confusing.
He's liberating him of his evilness.
Yeah, do you think he sees it like that?
I think he does.
I think he does, too.
Like he said, I'm absolving you of your imperfection. And it's his brother, and, you know, it turns out that he actually did at least care about his brother a little bit, so...
It's so interesting that...
Do we know for sure that he wasn't taking it just to keep him from stopping him?
No, that could be it, too.
Amon knew that his brother was weaker than him. He wouldn't really have been... wouldn't have posed as a threat.
Yeah, but that moment that he breaks through Tarlok's bloodbending... Tarlok can piece it together and realize, oh, this is my brother, and if he doesn't take his bending away, then Tarlok could expose him. Or if he just takes him prisoner and doesn't take his bending away, he can still expose him.
Not if he's prisoner.
Well, he might be able to.
Well, people get out of prison.
Yeah.
Katara being an example.
Yeah, I could actually see that. So yeah, I guess the question is whether he more like sees him as preventing a threat or sees his taking a bending as removing his impurity. At the same time, I wonder how much Amon really thinks that bending is an impurity, as he says, because it seems to me that his biggest motivation at the end is to take over a public city, maybe not to take everyone's bending away. I'm not sure, though.
I honestly think he kind of fell for his own... I don't know what to call it, but his own lies, his own things that he was saying, at least a little bit, because, you know, we do know that he hated bending, and... I think he portrayed it a certain way to be sympathetic towards non-benders, and I think maybe he fell into it a little bit, because one thing that we might discuss later that I never really understood is why was he wearing the makeup underneath his mask the entire time if he had no intention of ever removing the mask?
Well, maybe as a safeguard.
I know, but it just strikes me as odd.
Well, was he... having the makeup on under his mask the entire time.
Well, he had it on when the mask got taken off. He didn't know that somebody was going to come in and say, you're a liar, and then this happened, you know?
Well, maybe it's just, like, he just has them like the makeup on in case, like, there's maybe, like, doubt in the movement. They're saying, oh, you're probably not who you say you are.
True. Like, it's just, again, it's just something that struck me as odd.
Yeah, I think it's what Colin's saying.
That he had the makeup on. But, yeah, I mean, I honestly just think he kind of... to a certain extent, believes what he was saying, at least a little bit.
Well, it speaks volumes that the person in the series that hates bending more than anybody is himself. is a bender, and I mean, I wasn't on the podcast for a while, so I didn't get to really say this, but I actually predicted pretty early in the series that Amon would be a bender, just because I thought that would be a really interesting take on the story. I thought that would be really... I like that kind of whole, you know, undermining his whole plot in the first place. I just thought that would have been a really cool twist of the story, and it turned out I was right. But
yeah, that was a fairly prevalent fan thing, and it makes sense because you see people persecuting people who, when that person really is, yeah, throughout history. But yeah, it's... Let's move on, and we'll come back to all the stuff to the next, like, evidence thing, because this is an important scene here. I already talked about this a little bit. They find Korra and Mako find Tarlok kept prisoner in Air Temple Island. He seems genuinely remorseful in this scene. He says he's a soldier of revenge. He says his brother is too. And he talks about what I talked about before. So let's talk about Tarlok for a minute here, because do you think he... Well, his actions later kind of prove it, but what do you think his mindset is while being kept prisoner after his bending's taken away by Amon?
Like, please.
Go ahead.
Well, it seems like he's clearly been stewing, and I guess kind of maybe waiting for someone to come to him, or because, I mean, he seemed just so ready to just tell Korra everything. And granted, that might be, you know, the part of bad writing, but just that he seemed so ready just to take down Amon. He wanted all of this to be over, for everything to go back to, you know, just a semblance of normalcy. Since he lost his bending, that, like, there was no turning back for him, there was nothing for him.
I mean, I can see his, like, it was said, like, how he's so ready to say things. You know, I see this more, in my view, as a kind of hinting that maybe his motives weren't, maybe at least some of his motives weren't so self-centered the entire time, or maybe he did, on some level, have Republic City and the Benders' interests at heart. Maybe because he was counted among that particular demographic, but I think it lends itself to that.
Yeah, it's interesting, because another way to look at it is that he's just, like, just really depressed about, he sees what he's doing. I think this may be what they're hinting at. He sees what he's done, he sees what his brother's doing, and through seeing what his brother has done, he recognizes the error of his own ways and what their dad has done to them. And
yeah, that's what I wrote, is he's so ashamed of his own internal hypocrisy that he can't... This goes more toward the end, in the final scene, but he's so ashamed that he can't live with himself anymore.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
I just see him as depressed at the end. Which is, I guess, legitimate, but I'm not... The whole reason he would be depressed is because he feels he's, like, no power or anything left, because he sees what his father's influence has done to his brother and himself. And we only see 7-minute flashbacks of that, so I'm not sure how legitimate in the viewer's eyes it is.
I mean, well, I think the fact that we have differing views, you know, shows that it's not
all that. Yeah, none of this is clear-cut, as I said.
Because, I mean, like I said, I view it more as, you know, this is him. Yes, he's remorseful, but I think this lends itself again to the fact that he wasn't always acting the way he was for selfish gain. You know, part of it was trying to protect the city and trying to protect the vendors.
Well, I agree.
I kind of agree with Mel that he wasn't, because he seems... Like, after his bending was taken away and meeting his brother, that he seems legitimately surprised, like, with himself, that he's been doing what his father wanted all along. Like, it wasn't what he intended to do.
Another way to look at this is that, you know, here he is, finally, he's out from under the shadow of his brother in Republic City, and he's finally doing some good, and then here comes another bender stronger than him, and who's undermining him again, in front of, you know, people that are, that he's supposed to be, people that are in charge of him. So he just, you know, he's just so sick of this, and so that's why he goes after Korra. You could make the argument that really the only bad thing he does in the series, the only truly bad thing he does, is go after Korra.
Well, no, he in episode 8, he takes this horde of non-benders and...
He's rounding people up.
But like I said, I mean, I think that's part of the same thing. It's just this misguided attempt to get rid of Korra, who is a better bender than he is.
See, I don't see it that way. I mean, I get why you see it that way. That's not how I see it.
Well, going back to what Delaney said, I actually think that's... I haven't really thought about it like that before. What I took away from that is he thinks that he's doing good by, like, suppressing the Equalist movement and protecting the city. But then after he realizes who Amon is, he understands that he's just being an agent of revenge for his father. Because the only legit thing we get in the finale is that he says he and his brother both were turning into what his father wanted them to be. But I guess that might have not been the entire time. So he could have thought he was doing good before. But... It's kind of far-fetched to him to suddenly come to that realization. I don't know. I feel like he would have thought it through before and not just been so into his efforts.
Well, I feel like that's what we were supposed to get out of it, was that, like, the fact that he just realized that, because that's what was thrust at us, the reason why for all of the motivation for Amon and Tarlok was their father just being this horrible person and influencing them.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you guys see that as a legit thing?
I mean, anything could be a legit thing at this point, just because...
I think part of it might be that I'm less sympathetic toward the Equalist movement than the rest of you are.
No, I think Dylan is kind of...
No, I'm very sympathetic to the Equalist movement.
So, I think part of that is why we disagree, because I think that Tarlok is in the right in a lot of ways. I mean, granted, you know, disregarding the fact that it's Tarlok and that, you know, the things that happen, consequences of that are just bad, but, I mean, a curfew really I don't think is a bad idea. A lot of things he does are things that I think are okay, other than just what he does with, you know, trapping the non-violent non-benders and Korra. I really don't see a whole lot of issues with what he does.
You mean kidnapping her?
No, that's what I'm saying. Kidnapping
Putting
Korra,
her in a cage?
No, that's what I mean. Kidnapping Korra and all those things are bad, and I think that's a moment where Tarlok deviates from the kind of person he normally is. And
he's
that's
going
why
crazy.
And that's why we see him as remorseful in the cage. Because he realizes that he's gone astray.
I think what he's saying is that he wanted to be this good councilman for the city even before he went astray, but even so, I think he thinks that that was just his father's influence on him. That's what I very much took away from his lines with Korra and Mako in that scene.
You mean the things he does to Korra and the non-violent non-benders are because of his father?
Even before that, I think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying his entire... because he's power-hungry at the very least before that, and I think he's saying that his power-hungriness just stemmed from his father, and now he finally suddenly realizes that.
Well,
yeah, and you can say that, because you can be power hungry and still be a good person. You can still be ambitious and have good intentions.
Like the Slytherins.
Yes, Mel.
Well, something Josh brought up, I think, because we were talking about how it just seems so unrealistic for Tarlok to have this sudden realization of what all he's done. He's talking, well, just reminded me of when they're in the lodge. Tarlok is at his lowest point, almost. He hasn't gotten his bending taken away, but, you know, he just looks crazy. Did anyone else think that?
Is he going to go into the Avatar state because he's at his lowest point?
I mean, you bring up
he's
a good
breaking
point.
Down.
You bring up a good point, though, that his, you know, his change was so fast, and that's why, again, I say it had to have been there the entire time on some level for it to have switched so fast. And maybe it took, you know, something to trigger the realization, like, you know, the fact that this is his lowest point, or...
Yeah.
That he kidnapped, you know, the Avatar. Like, he realizes that this power hungriness, this want for power, and what he's doing to the non-benders is just another form of what his father had wanted him to do in the first place.
And I think if that was there, like, lying underneath the surface, his remorsefulness, it was not presented in the show. So I'm not, we can maybe speculate about, but I'm not sure we can take that away from anything that happened.
Well, that's what I take away.
Well, yeah, no, we have to go beyond what was in the show, as I keep saying. Okay, we need to move on. Next scene, Noah talks / Amon. I said I'd call him Amon. Amon comes to Tarlok, after he's been exposed. He says, I'm sorry for what I had to do to you. Tarlok says, our fathers set us on this path. Fate caused us to collide. Amon says, leave with me now. We have a second chance. Please, you're all I have left in the world. So, what do you think Amon is thinking right now?
I think what he said was genuine, because of what I said earlier about how, you know, the reason he really, the only real reason he took Tarlok's bending was because he saw him as a threat for exposing him. So, you know, I don't think he really wanted to take Tarlok's bending away, but he thought in the moment that he had to. So, I'm sorry for what I had to
do. Well, this is interesting, though, that he says, I'm sorry for what I had to do with you, because, you know, this is a guy who hates bending, and he's apologizing for taking bending away.
I guess what Mike and Brian would say to that is that he's come out of this fog and realized that his hatred of bending is all just from his father now.
Reunited, oh, everything can be better now.
I disagree with that.
I mean, I don't know what evidence. I'm not sure what. See, this again, what the show is telling us, I don't know, like, what.
Well, the problem with Amon is that he's so back and forth with what he says and what's presented to us that it's hard to tell how he really feels.
He's up there with Mako now with all this flippy floppy.
Well, I mean, like, he's like, oh, I'm absolving you of your imperfection, and then now he's apologizing to Tarlok for taking his bending away.
Well, the fact that he's a bender and he uses his bending to proclaim non-bending is itself, you know, dual nature, hypocrisy, whatever you want to call it. So I think you're right. I think you've got it on the money, Mel.
Well, sure, but he could still hate benders. But I'm not sure.
I mean, I don't know. It's
like the way he looks at it is definitely, I have to keep my bending and use it to take people's bending away because that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, he sees himself as a double standard, perhaps, in this.
Yeah, but
a lot of movements like these, that's how it is. That there has to be some sort of just double standards, you know, hypocrisy where it just doesn't work. Just like, I mean, any movement, like with, especially with Hitler and things like that, just these kinds of leaders, these cults of personality, this is how it turns out.
It's interesting that in the scene, Tarlok's the only one that mentions that the Our Father set us on this path thing. It's actually, Amon doesn't seem like he necessarily agrees with that. He doesn't say anything to that effect.
He hated their father so much, and I mean, he left them.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what if that is really Amon's train of thought. It might just be. But I see. Here's what I thought of Amon at the end. He's like, we have to leave now. We have a second chance. It's like, oh, I'm just throwing away this movement. This is another chance for me to have power. I don't know what he's.
It's like you're telling kind of.
Well, it's a lot like, you know, not exactly, but it's a lot like Azula. In that absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, we see we have two benders here that are, you know, ridiculous prodigies and so good at bending, and it just totally messes with their minds and the way that they view the world. And, you know, I don't think it's really out of character for Amon to be this, to have this double hypocrisy thing, because I think that's just part of the package when you have the crazy, prodigious abilities and an overbearing father that pushes you too far.
Okay, and now we have to get into the last scene, but here's a one definite way to interpret this is that Amon has given up. But so he says, leave with me, we have a second chance. And then we get into that scene where he does nothing to stop his own death.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I viewed that in seeing that scene. The entire time was that Amon was aware of what Tarlok was going to do, and he was giving up.
It's the way the scene is framed, it's hard not to imagine that Amon didn't know that Tarlok was doing something. He was standing, sure his back was turned to him, but Tarlok moves very slowly with the glove, and Amon's kind of looking out into nowhere. And then he sheds a tear, so.
Why he just does
it? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I just think he just does that because, like, he just, like, in throughout the whole series, both of them saying, like, they're trying not to be like their father, but, like, once they realize that, like, they become, like, their weapons of their father, like, they just see that there's no point in continuing. Like, no matter where they go, they're always going to have, like, that bit of their father in them. And that's why the only way to, like, to get rid of it is, I guess, to pull yourself up. And that's why, I think that's what, like, Amon just accepted that fact, and that's why, like, Tarlok initially did that in the first place, because no matter what they do, they're just always going to have a bit of them, of their father in them. That's what I think.
But it contradicts, like, what Amon just said. Like, that now we have a second chance, and to think that he wouldn't try and stop them having a second chance, though I guess you could say them dying and going to the possibly spirit world, we don't know how that works, could be a second chance.
Yeah, I think you're both right. I think what Colin said is the way Mike and Brown want us to interpret that. I don't think that necessarily contradicts his last line, because he could have just been saying empty sentiments, like, please, let's leave and do something else, but he didn't really believe what he was saying.
I mean, if we assume that Amon, you know, truly did think bending was evil and he needed to free people of it, I think maybe it's possible that he realized at some point after all this went down that, yes, he had become like his father. He'd become this oppressive bully, even though he was trying to fight that, because he assumed bending was the root of all evil, was the root of all oppression, and he realized that he was just furthering his own belief by using his bending to oppress people. And perhaps, you know, this is, because I took that scene as him giving up, him knowing that what Tarlok was about to do. So that's my only way I can rationalize that.
Well, did anyone think that Tarlok did, that Amon didn't give up?
I don't think, I didn't think he knew and that was going on, to be honest.
Okay, well, what do you see his motivations as then?
Well, I mean, for him just not reacting, or...
Yeah, well, do you think, so you just think you're taking him at face value for his second chance thing?
Well, not just, I saw this scene really as a parallel to what happened with Yukon, because he left, had another chance with this woman, had two kids. That it's kind of a parallel of that scene, the two brothers leaving, but then I don't really think Amon knew his brother was about to blow them all up. So I think he really thought that they could have a second chance, and that maybe they could do what their father did and leave everything behind, then have more children that were corrupted and...
Well, yeah, I mean, if they go, you know, like their father did, like, go off, have another chance, look what their father did with his second chance. I mean, he had kids and, you know, caused his kids to hate them and pretty much corrupted them for the rest of their lives. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think Amon wants to go down that road, and certainly not Tarlok.
But he thinks continue.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say
Blaney.
Okay. I just thought Amon thought that he was better than his father, he could do better. I mean, look at him taking people's bending away with the gift that he got from his father, and he thought he was making the world a better place, but the Avatar foiled him, and he has to disappear.
Well, so did Tarlok. I mean, Tarlok said, like, he tried to do the exact opposite of what his father was doing. Like, he said, like, I forget which episode, he said that he had the whole planned out. He wanted to be the city's hero, change everything his father did, but he still became just like his father.
I think it's really interesting. I think that Amon has a profound respect for the Avatar. Even though, you know, he realizes that he has to take her bending away eventually, and that's just part of his plan, but I think he still has respect due to the way that he approaches, you know, taking her bending away in Voice of the Night, and taking the way he says what he says to his father about how the Avatar has the better power than you do and everything. I think it's really interesting that he has that respect for her.
Well, what do you think about, I think you were away for a few seconds. Do you think Amon knew what Tarlok was doing in the boat scene? Do you think he knew that they were trying to kill him, and do you think that he genuinely thought they had a second chance, or do you think that he gave up?
I think he genuinely thought they had a second chance. I don't have an opinion on whether he thought that whether he knew Tarlok was going to do that. It was a very Christopher Nolan-esque scene at that point, and I really am not comfortable going either way on that.
Well, I think, I give Mike and Brian a lot of grief about the way they present certain things. I think that this scene was genuinely meant to be ambiguous between the two things we're discussing here. We're pretty much evenly split, and I think it was ridiculously well done. We don't know what Amon was thinking. We don't know if he realized Tarlok was doing this. He could have been very easily realized that he's doing this, but the tear, it could go either way. And I think that was just fairly brilliant. And it almost absolves their mistreatment of this in the finale. But I'm not sure it quite does, because the rest of what we discussed needs more evidence, needed more screen time, so we could figure out what these major characters' motives are. We don't know. We pretty much have no idea.
I was away for a few seconds. Did we talk about Tarlok's motivations for blowing up the boat yet? Are we going to?
We can get back into that for a minute. I didn't hear any opinions other than that he gave up. He'd pretty much given up on on life, and he realized that they couldn't stray from his father's path.
Well, I wrote, I was taking some notes before we started, and I wrote down a couple things about why I thought. The first one was what I said earlier about how he's just so ashamed of his own internal hypocrisy that he can't live with himself anymore, so this is what he does. The other thought was that, you know, he's trying to remove all remnants of his family from the world, and this is the best way he sees that he can do that, because he knows that his father's dead, and he just, you know, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where he's generally good, generally a good person, just, you know, goes about things the wrong way. Or the other thing was, he doesn't really want to kill himself, but he doesn't think he'll have a better opportunity to off him on his own.
I think that last one's possible. I agree with you on wanting to remove his family from the world.
I agree with that, and I got confused when I thought we were about him wanting to give up. I thought that was Iman.
Oh, no, yeah, Tarlok just, I mean, Tarlok does kill them, so.
But yeah, I mean, I thought that was more of, I do agree with the whole, that wanting to destroy the family, because I think it ties into what I thought was the parallel that he didn't want to happen with them, didn't want what happened with Yukon to happen with them. You know,
well, I think going off of that, Tarlok sees, like, what you said earlier, where, they're going off to have a second chance, just like their father, and Tarlok understands that when their father went off to have a second chance, he basically screwed it up,
yeah.
Well, for their entire family, so he's going to stop it in its tracks.
Yeah. I mean, it's, so I guess one of the final questions would be, do you see that as legitimately presented within the show? Because Tarlok's motivations seem very... he seemed to change very fast. We get that to some extent Tarlok wants to stop their family. He's given up on the world, maybe, or he just wants to get rid of Iman. Do you see this as presented well in the finale?
I think Tarlok's motivations are presented a lot clearer than Iman's.
Well, maybe clearer,
yes.
But it's there's also a drastic shift.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily too well presented. I mean, definitely better than Iman's, but just because we went from him being a villain and you hating him to him becoming this really sympathetic character way too fast, and then just everything's kind of jumbled up.
Yeah, and I think with Iman, they were trying to keep him ambiguous, his motivations, but the problem is you can't do that with the main villain and this thing that the show hinged on so much for the entire season. It was presented so well in that final scene, but I almost don't think it's worth it.
See, something I really enjoy about watching these series by Mike and Brian is how they present the villains in the series, and they do it in a way that really clearly gives a really clear story of a family dynamic. Something I noticed about these three men, Yukon, Noatak, and Tarlok, they all three have identity crisis, or they have a moment where they have to change their identity. Yukon becomes a father as opposed to being a crime boss. Noatak becomes Iman, and then Tarlok becomes a councilman. And they all have to wear these masks and these disguises. And, you know, I think at the end Tarlok realizes this, and he realizes how just rotten his family is, and that's why he does what he does.
Kind of like a Zuko dynamic is what you're getting at.
But yeah, I mean, they're not exactly the same story, but it's really similar how they present the villains as a family, and they not only have, you know, conflicts against the protagonists, but they always have conflicts within that family dynamic.
Well, it's interesting because that's like kind of what happened in Star Wars, was the villain and the hero. I mean, I'm just saying. Villain and the hero, it was, you know, it was a glorified version of the family dynamic, you know, gone wrong. And the fact that in these prominent families like the royal family in the Fire Nation or this bloodbending family from the north, you know, prominent families, you know, get, you know, when things happen between them, everyone is affected.
Well, you could argue that both Iman and Tarlok just have really overblown Oedipal complexes.
You could. I wouldn't.
Yeah, but okay, going back...
I mean, okay, just the father part, the other part.
We don't...
Yeah, well, to have an Oedipal complex, you need both parts. So.
Okay, going back to what Josh said earlier, it's interesting that they try to present the family dynamic so much with the villains. In this case, I think it was forced in Korra.
I think it was definitely more in the original series with Ozai and Azula and Zuko.
I mean, it's a function of them hiding Amon's identity. That's the reason that it was forced, and it's a give and take, but you almost wish that they had gone a different route and not tried to force this family thing on us at the end, even though they presented it so well in the flashbacks and in this final scene.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
if they just had stretched it out a bit, it would have been perfectly fine, but they crammed it in 8 minutes.
Yeah, so would you say that maybe they have the right idea, but they didn't adapt well enough to the miniseries format?
They tried,
instead of doing a different kind of show, they just tried to do Avatar in less time?
Possibly. I think they tried to, what I've been getting from hearing them talk in interviews is that they made a list of ideas in the beginning, and they said, we want to put all these things in this season. And they said, okay, we don't have time for like one or two. But then they just crammed the rest of them in, which is why we got the mecha tanks in just one random episode. And they're like barely.
Even though that was something people speculated from episode one when we saw the drawings in the back, we're like, oh, what is a
mobile
building?
Well, yeah, they put that in there. But it's like they focus on in one episode. They just have to, they're like, let's hit on this, let's hit on this, let's hit on this. I'm not sure. I think the family dynamic was created as an explanation. Later, after they came up with the concept of Amon.
Yeah, I definitely think they came up with the concept of Amon and then gave him a backstory.
So I'm not sure that they tried to bring Avatar into Korra. I just think that's what they reverted to, maybe.
I don't think they tried to emulate Avatar. I'm just saying that that's something that is part of their... A lot like how Miyazaki always has flying and always has a female protagonist. You know, part of Mike and Brian's idea of a villain is they also want to present... They want to present the relationships of the villains as well as the conflict.
Yes, maybe.
I think that's just part of. I think that's just their MO.
Okay,
but we only have two series of that though, and we have tons of whatever that guy's name's movies. Though I haven't seen any. I know there's a lot.
Don't say that to Dylan.
Yeah, I think there's not enough. We haven't seen enough from the two series to necessarily know that that's what Meg and Brian do. Because we got Zhao, and he didn't really have a family thing. We had more villains. We have tons of side villains in Avatar, which people sometimes forget about. Combustion Man, Xinfu.
Because we didn't have any in Legend of Korra.
That's fair, but I'm just saying this is a trend that I noticed.
It is. No, I agree. It's a trend. I'm not sure.
I don't think it's intentional.
That's a legit trend. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it could. It could just be like a subconscious.
I mean, the problem is like, I'm an English major, and one thing you never do, or you're really not supposed to do, is come up with a plot and then put characters in it to fit it. You come up with characters and then come up with a plot that fits them. That way you avoid having stuff like this, where you have characters or incidents that are plot devices.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did. They came up with Amon. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I'm fairly certain they came up with Amon and then said, okay, now what's his backstory to fit into all this?
That's how he went from going really, seeming really, really neat to, oh, okay.
Yeah.
What's this?
Yeah, I agree. And I think it could have been done acceptably, or not, that's a dumb word. It could have been done well, but they just crammed it at the end. They could have give us more things throughout. It's okay to have Amon just be this mysterious figure and then show him at the end without having too much evidence, too much foreshadowing. But you need some, or else it just seems rushed and random.
Yeah. Again, it bothers me just because by having him in that mask and all that, they were, you know, almost daring us to guess his identity, and we never would have been able to in the first place because we didn't know.
Yeah, until they got into their second, what I like to call the second like string of ship episodes.
Yeah,
starting with episode 8.
For me, it fits the way I like to watch movies and stuff. The way they did it fit me more than I think it did most people, because I actually do enjoy having things open-ended and, you know, not clearly explained. You know, a lot of people were so upset about Zuko's mom, and I don't necessarily think that it was a bad thing that they left it out. I wouldn't have even cared if they weren't going on to make a new comic about it. It really wouldn't matter to me. I actually find that more interesting sometimes than making everything clear.
I think that's not necessarily a good comparison, because I'm with you on Zuko's mom. But that's a minor plot line.
See, I understand what you're saying, and I agree. Like, I like the ambiguity of Amon's character in the gray area. However, I do not like the ambiguity of a plotline like that, because that's not really something subjective.
You can't present this.
I'm kind of in the middle.
You can't present this huge plotline and then not tell us what Amon's motivations are at the end. You don't have to spell it out for us, but you have to give us some idea of what it is. We don't really have any idea what Amon's motivations were this whole series. Like, we tried to guess on this podcast. Yeah, and we don't know what his plan was. He definitely had one, but we don't know what it was.
I forgot he had a plan.
Yeah, he definitely did. So.
It's easy, too, because we never found out what it was.
And people have been saying his plan was just to take over the city, and I don't buy that. That's a dumb plan.
No, I think his plan was to take off his mask and be like, I really do have a scar, and someone push him in the water.
That was totally his plan, yeah.
That's what it was.
He didn't even save Korra for last. He took her bending away when he had to, so we don't.
That was so lame.
Well, if you another way to look at this is that Amon, you know, if he could have just said, "I'm going to take away bending from everybody because I'm evil," but it was the message he sent was very specific. It was one of I don't like being bullied. I didn't like how our father he didn't have bending, but used bending to force us to do what he wanted us to do. And I think that was part of the message behind the Equalist movement. And so I think that maybe it's a little bit more clear, his motivations more clear. Maybe his plan wasn't, maybe he didn't have a good plan. I mean, okay, that's the joke he doesn't plan. But what I'm saying is that that might be part of his character, how I was talking earlier about how these people, these prodigious benders, just have this really messed up mentality. You know, he has this message that he wants to give, but he just doesn't do it in the right way, and it's very sloppily done, and that's how he's able to be beaten in the end.
If Amon's motivations really are that he wants to take bending away, it wasn't presented clear enough. It was spelled out for us in one line.
I don't think it's necessarily want to take bending away. I think it's remove oppressive bending.
I would say the same thing to that. We get one line from Tarlok, Amon blamed bending for everything. You can't just have one line and expect that to justify episodes and episodes of
specifically
this thing.
When Amon contradicts that occasionally too.
With imperfections and that, thinking it's an impurity.
And when he apologized to his brother for taking his bending away, if he felt so strongly about it, why would he do it? Why would he apologize?
Yeah.
You can interpret that in a different way, that he wasn't apologizing for taking his bending away, but merely just, like,
hurting his brother,
hurting him in any fashion, yeah.
Fair enough, but still, I agree that you can't give us one line from Tarlok and then expect us to take that as the answer to why he's acting this way.
And I don't necessarily disagree with you. I think what we're talking about now is just a difference in, you know, what we're satisfied with. I was actually pretty satisfied with the amount of clarity, even if it wasn't that much.
Well, no, what I thought was, like, I mean, I understand that's what you think, and I think I speak for a good number of us that what was so annoying was that both of his plans, out of the two plans that have been suggested, that they were both so ambitious, and then we get one line kind of explaining it, because, like, it just, to take away everyone's bending, that's such an ambitious, large-scale plan, and then we get one line, and then stopping oppressive people, I mean, that's also...
And what I'm saying is I think that just kind of fits him, though, because of what I said about him being this prodigious, mentally messed up guy.
Okay, and then even if you interpret it that way, though,
all prodigious benders are crazy.
Okay,
well, no, not all of them, obviously, but
what Mel said,
we have several examples.
What Mel said, plus that the fact that showing him as a prodigious bender was in one 7-minute flashback scene, and it was only a part of that, and even that was barely presented.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but no, I get what you're saying, though, and it is more of a personal taking somewhat away from that, though. But I would say that this is one of the biggest problems with the finale, is Amon's justification for taking bending away. I'd put it up there with the Equalist movement and the logic between Amon taking people's bending away at all. And if you notice, all three of those things aren't Korra's airbending, and there are problems. I'd say those are maybe the three biggest problems, and they're all about Amon and the Equalist movement and the villain side, and that's because that was so much more established throughout the series than Korra's airbending, which was just one episode, and then she did a few poses here and there, and her spirituality, which is also barely presented. So it doesn't need too, those didn't need too big of justifications. They shouldn't have been random non-explanation things either. But it's not, those aren't the fatal problems with the finale. Not that I thought the finale failed. I thought it was quite good, but you can't.
Well, I just think Amon's plotline came very close to failing, in my opinion, at the end.
I agree with Mel.
On an overall level, it's very hard to disagree too much with that. And I think that's something I would say about Korra upon another season review. If you take each episode on its own, it's much better than if you take it as an entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I actually think episode 10 is the best episode in the series in terms of its function as an episode.
I still like Voice in the Night. Because that's when Amon was still cool.
Thank you. I love that episode, too.
In terms of a function. Okay, I get what you're saying, Josh. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it. Certain episodes are better from a season holistic standpoint than individually.
I think the lieutenant came up with the plan, and that's why it sucked.
Needed more on the lieutenants. Oh, that is what, like I said in the season, that was one thing they did so well at the end.
Has it been pointed out on this podcast that lieutenant is basically Team Rocket?
I don't know what that means. Oh, like, yes, I do. What am I saying?
he should have gone blasting off at the end, yeah. That would have been good. Okay, we are 20 minutes over time, so let's end this. Yeah, we're about 15 minutes into this right now, so I apologize for our first one, and we're already over. Okay, that's all for this mini-cast. I've been your main host, Dylan. Mini-hosts have been Colin, Josh, Delaney. I don't know if I should put Mel in there, but I'm saying Mel, too.
Why?
Because you're... I don't know. The word.
Whatever. I'm here.
You're here too.
Said as you will.
Yeah. The podcast is okay. This is for them. I produce and co-create the podcast, Dong the Fang Zone by Jake. So yeah. Hopefully that went well. Send us your thoughts on this extensive topic, and maybe we'll get into it again later. Anything to end on? Ideas?
Got nothing.
Okay. Let's end on bye then. I want to establish that as a precedent anyway.
What is this?
For the minicast. Okay. So let's end on bye, guys. 1, 2, 3. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Hello and welcome to From the Spirit World, a legendary Avatar the Last Airbender and Legend of Korra podcast. If you want extensive, in-depth discussion on Korra from longtime knowledgeable fans of Avatar and longtime fandom members, then this is the podcast for you. I am your main host, Mel, and today I am joined by Sam.
That's so weird hearing you do that.
Yeah. And our new mini hosts, although you've already heard one of them already, probably by the time this podcast comes out, is Delaney.
Hello.
Who is someone on the forum.
I'm Sergeant.
Sergeant, that's, I knew that. I am so sorry. This is Sergeant Nerd at Arms. We have Ryan.
Hi.
He is Toasty on the forums. And we have Lem.
Hi.
Who is Swordbender on the forums. Yes?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Got them right. Sorry, Delaney. This is a mini-cast where we discuss a single topic of Avatar or Korra for a brief time. Brief being between 10 and 20 minutes, or 10 and 30 minutes. First time I recorded this, it went 50 minutes. So we're going to try not to do that. Our topic shouldn't be as long as the last one. Today we're discussing specifically airbending and its real life influences, specifically one of my favorite films of all time, film series of all time, Star Wars, specifically the Jedi philosophies presented in Star Wars and similarities between that and airbending. So I'm going to attempt to not do a lot of talking. However, my outline kind of sucks. So I'm hoping these guys...
It's a very good outline.
I'm hoping these guys help me out with making sure you don't hear my voice the entire time. So, first we're going to do an overview of airbending philosophies and code of conduct. So, I guess I just want to go around and see what your guys' impression is of how you view airbending. And in terms of, I guess, in comparison to the other styles, because this is a culture that, to me, is very segregated and very different from all the others. So I just want to go around and see what you guys, your initial impressions of that are. Just anyone?
I don't know.
I mean,
well, they're the air nomads, so they're very nomadic in their airness.
Thanks.
You don't see a lot of that.
Thank you for that. I wouldn't have guessed.
Wouldn't have guessed the air nomads were nomadic.
Well, they are they are segregated. Because, you know, they obviously have their air temples that, like, barely anybody can get to if you don't have a flying bison, so.
No.
Yeah.
They don't seem most detached from everyone else. Like, they don't have families like everyone else, and.
Until Tenzin. Kaya and Bumi.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. Things have kind of changed for the air nomads since they got wiped out.
I would imagine that would happen.
But yeah, I mean, specifically here, I have, you know, specific tenets of their lifestyles. I mean, vegetarianism, they're the only group I think we've seen, only nation group we've seen that are vegetarians. And there's no really any specific reason given, I don't think, is there?
Well, they respect all life.
Okay. I wrote that down, but I didn't know if I was correct.
Come on.
Yeah.
From a martial arts perspective, they're the most different. I'm a martial artist myself, and I'd like to just express this thought real quick.
We can have a conversation about that later.
Cool beans. I know it's mainly like kung fu styles, and I take karate, but that I've seen tai chi and airbending resembles to me a lot tai chi with the flowing movements and how easy and just the ease of movement and how it's relaxed as opposed to, you know, fire bending and how just. I guess you could say exciting or violent as it is, and that reflects the culture a lot. In comparison to the other bending, because the bending styles are all very representative of the cultures.
Yeah, I specifically want to get into kung fu and airbending a little bit later, and I think you can help me on that too, because I also do karate. But it's interesting, there are the differences between kung fu and karate, but we'll get into that in a minute. So vegetarianism. I also put down that it was a belief in reincarnation. Because I believe it is Buddhism. That's one of the reasons they don't eat meat, is because you might be eating your friend who is reincarnated into.
Well, that friend that didn't do a very good job at life.
No, I would think animals are good.
If they ended up like a deer instead of like an inchworm, they did okay.
Like, no one wants to be a flower.
Not best, but okay.
Guys.
What?
What if they reincarnate into an animal that attaches to another animal, and that's why they're hybrid animals?
In Avatar?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Like, to reflect their personality, they're not a tiger or a bear, so they're a tiger bear.
Exactly.
Tiger
they turn into a tiger, and their friend turns into a bear. Saying. So they turn into a tiger bear.
Well, okay. That's interesting. Save that thought. I also have here, their existence is pretty much the term I have is religious. Spiritual is probably a better one, just because we've seen, you know, so much meditation. They live in temples.
The monks do.
I think they all do, because I believe every member of the Air Nation is a bender, because are so spiritual.
But they don't all become monks, because how else would there be more airbenders?
Sam and I have a theory on that. Would you like to share that,
do.
Sam?
Okay. It's basically like they assign people to, you know, and do the deed and whatnot to give birth.
Okay.
Kind of like
basically
the
like that's their job. Like, if you've ever read The Giver, like they have like an assignment job sort of thing called birth mother, and that's what they do. So that is the theory.
Yeah, our theory is basically there are certain monks who are assigned to be.
And those children get like, you know, farmed out to whatever temple.
Yeah,
but they wouldn't be nomads.
Yeah, they would.
They would just be, because I assume, you know, being monks, they, you know, are celibate.
Well, that's the problem I have with, because we only see Aang, we only see the monk side.
Oh, they're all dead, it's not their fault.
I know, I'm just saying that what I think is that they do have air nomads who they used to travel, but the people learning airbending, like from, I don't know, like 4 to 16, because we know Aang was just taken because they thought he was the Avatar as an infant, to train them, and then they leave.
Here's my impression of it, just because we haven't seen enough of it, and this kind of ties in with what Jedis do. I think, you know, airbenders are born, and then they're taken to a temple away from the temple where they were born at, so they are separated from their parents, and they learn airbending, and then they can go off and be nomadic. I mean, that's my impression of it.
I could see that.
And I mean, again, that's...
And the higher ups, just like, say, at the temples.
Yeah. I mean, and it, we'll get into it in a little bit with, you know, Jedi's, you know, kids who are recognized as being Force-sensitive people are taken from their families at a young age so they don't grow attached to them. So, lack of materialism. I mean, they live as monks.
They'd, yeah.
That's about, I mean...
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, their staff, that's it.
They're just there. With
they seem pretty attached to their staffs and their, like, their medallions and stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
Aang
that's,
destroyed his.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, but that's about it, though. I mean, they're attached to their spiritual and objects, and their objects with bending, but you don't see them walking around with, like, bling or anything.
What about the air sword? Is that a fly?
No.
Well, Roku had the crown.
Well, Roku wasn't. I mean, Roku
did what he wanted.
Yeah,
I was
Roku
like,
does what he
not
wants.
An airbender. I don't know why I said that. I apologize.
Yeah, no, it's okay. He's an airbender, so whatever.
He was trying. He failed at trying to be a true airbender. I mean, with keeping his
Roku's
his
just
crown.
Terrible.
I mean, he was told he couldn't have any stuff either. So I don't know why I brought that up.
Just terrible.
And this one's interesting. Right. This last point is interesting, and we see it in. I forget the episode numbers, but it's The Serpent's Pass. Spirituality over emotions, where, you know, Aang says, you know, the monks said abandon hope because it just gets in the way of...
Oh yeah, I got some stuff on that.
Okay, would you like to share it now, or do you think it...
Yeah, I'll just do it now.
All right,
Oh, geez, I can't find it. Okay, just talk about something then.
Okay.
Got it.
All right.
All right. Well, this is going to tie into Jedi. I'm not sure if we should be doing that this early.
So.
We're like almost there.
We are so close. Yeah.
Okay,
you know what? Yeah, do that because that'll segue into it. So yeah, go for it.
All right. Okay. So basically, the Jedi. If you follow, like, I'm sorry about this, but the Star Wars prequels, they're not allowed to have like a family.
I like how you apologize.
Well, I am sorry.
I am so sorry for bringing that up.
Of them suck, so, okay. Anyway, stop. Anyway, the Jedi, they can't have wives. You see Anakin and, like, Padme, they can't really have a wife or family. They're celibate, basically. And it's the same thing with the nomads. They're detached from the world with spiritual enlightenment and stuff. And again, what's his name? How can I forget his name? Oh, Aang.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Luke Skywalker kind of destroys that, because if you followed like the comics after Star Wars, he gets married. Same thing with Aang.
I think, is the true destroyer of all that.
Yeah, he destroyed everything. Like, he had one job, which is to follow that air nomad culture, and he has a kid. But I guess that's okay, because we have Tenzin, so...
Yeah, and that's a good segue into now where
this
overlap with Jedi philosophies. And specifically what Lem is talking about here is, you know, Anakin, again, in the prequel films, we learn that Jedi's, first of all, I'm not going to introduce this because I trust we all know what a Jedi is, even if you have not seen Star Wars.
If you don't, why are you listening
to the
podcast?
Like, sticks.
Yeah, you shouldn't be listening to this if you don't know. But anyway, Jedi's also specifically a specific phrasing in the Jedi Code states that no emotion.
And there is no emotion, there is peace.
Yes, that's the exact wording, is you don't bring your emotions into account ever, which is something that Aang brought up when he was depressed and they were crossing the Serpent's Pass, and he was saying, you know, he was detaching himself from all emotion, and he was saying, oh, we can't focus on hope because it gets in the way.
Kind of the same thing.
Rational.
He was kind of irrational because of Appa and everything. I'm not so sure if that's exactly what they said. Maybe there was a hidden meaning behind that. I don't know. They're tricky guys, those air nomads. But, like, the thing is, like, at the time, he was going through all this conflict and everything, and he was so inclined to give up hope. So I'm not sure if we can completely put all our faith in the credibility of that statement.
True. I mean, it may not be something important, to Air Nomads, because he mentioned it at a time when it was convenient for him to be detached.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is something that he was taught once, that to not let yourself get deluded with too many emotions and focus on the task at hand.
Right. He is 12.
Yeah, well.
Yingtin,
is he a reliable narrator? Literature classes. Okay, so Jedi Code also states, and again, I don't have the exact wording, but they're not aggressors, they're protectors. So they're not aggressive, they attack when they have to protect something, the peace of, in their case, the peace of, you know, the Republic. Which, you know, we see in the Air Nomads' bending style. It's defensive. The bending style itself is completely defensive, and as
very
far
evasive.
As evasive
jinx
and defensive, defensive. And they don't even, I think they don't even have a standing army.
No,
they can't.
Well, they could.
They would have lost. I mean
Wang was like in
prepared.
Was it like the headband? The Air Nomads didn't have an army. So
yeah,
they didn't.
He did say they didn't have an army. Again, Jedi have a very spiritual existence. They are essentially warrior monks with the way they live. And
there's no passion, there's serenity. There we go.
There you go.
Oh, man.
I have them all written out. I apologize.
No, please, continue.
She apologizes too. It's not just me.
So yeah, religious existence, I think we all agree on that. Or spiritual, however you want to put it.
And a big one would be, there's no chaos, there is harmony. Now, this one's not usually included with some of the texts we have, like you would say we have on the Jedi Code. That's a big thing, I would think, that the Air Nomads, you know, they believe in harmony, especially with, you know, the animals, we talked about that, and with the other nations, and also ties into the Avatar, and...
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, no, I agree. Lack of materialism... I think Anakin specifically states in the second movie that materialism is forbidden.
When they can't have attachments.
When he's listing off all the things that are forbidden, and then he proceeds to break every single one of them.
In succession.
Chronological order.
Yeah. But yeah, basically, you know, because they wear, you know, there's like Air Nomads. They all wear variations of the same basic outfit. You know, they don't...
Yeah, they're not lavish at all or anything.
They're essentially monks.
Yeah. And we went over spirituality over emotion. So this is where I think Ryan has something to add to this. But basically, the reason these two are similar is because they draw influences from the same places from real-world religions. So, Ryan, do you want to go first with Taoism?
Sure. I just wanted to say, like, Taoism believes a lot of non-action, non-doing, like just like Jedis and Air Nomads, how they try to avoid conflict and... you only use fighting as a last resort.
Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. Yeah, I missed that one, so that's good. Yeah, Taoism. Yeah. It's basically kind of a passive existence, I guess, in terms of that sort of, you know, with conflict.
Right.
So, I guess the big one is I cannot pronounce this word, and I'm going to butcher it, and somebody's going to email in and tell me I'm ridiculous.
Yeah.
Monasticism. It basically
Gnosticism?
Means sure. It basically means being a monk or monkhood, which is present in like every religion throughout the world. In some capacity, there are monks. So, you know, that's not something specific. What is specific is Hinduism, and I specifically wrote the Bhagavad Gita, and I forget why. So I'm going to go look that up now. So somebody talk.
So
Hinduism, though.
All right. Okay. Buddhism deals a lot with not being attached to anything.
Kind of wish I would have taken more religion classes.
I have a friend who's Hindu, so I know some things.
Okay, I found it. Okay, so basically, it's a specific passage in the Bhagavad Gita that deals with lack of attachment. And it's basically almost mirrors exactly what Yoda says in the first prequel, I think, where basically...
Wait, hold
on.
What? This is the one I wanted to read.
Okay.
Is this the fear one?
No, but I know what you're going to say, so just
okay.
Say it.
All right, let's do this. Okay. A little excessive. Okay. okay. Hold on. Okay, here we go. Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
Yes.
Okay, there we go.
That's what I was referring to.
Okay, there we go.
And you got a live reenactment here, mm-hmm. only on Dongbufeng.
Where else?
Exclusive.
But anyway, what I was saying was that specific quote goes back to something mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, which says, from attachment springs desire, and from desire comes anger, which is something similar to what Yoda said. It's that in his case, it's fear, but, you know, it's all the same thing. You know, once you have attachment, there's fear of loss as well, and it leads to emotions that are harmful to others. So that's why I have in there Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, Shaolin monks, this is where I want to talk to Delaney for a second, because I mentioned this before on the podcast, the differences between karate and kung fu. Kung fu is a spiritual martial art in that it does not seek to completely destroy its opponent. It seeks only to incapacitate them for the sake of karma, because, you know, you don't want to kill someone and then have to deal with that later in life, that negative energy coming back at you. Karate was developed in Japan by bodyguards as a form of martial arts that would do its best to kill its opponent as quickly as possible and hurt them as much as possible, which is why you have hard punches and knocks, whereas kung fu is more sweeping movements that attack the energy flows of the body.
And karate's about getting the final death blow, shobui pun.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you agree on that being also
a... I don't know a lot about kung fu. I just know that it's Chinese and karate's Japanese and came from when the Chinese attempted to invade Japan. But I know that, yes, I do agree that, I mean, that's with our kumite style, it's the killing blow, one point, shobui pun, the death blow. Mm-hmm. So I do agree. It's all about you want to finish the fight as quickly as possible, resulting in the death of your opponent.
Yeah, and kung fu seeks to do the opposite.
Yes.
And another thing I have on here is Tibetan Buddhism, where they believe in as meditation as a form of growth of knowledge. The use of gurus, I think, is specific to Buddhism as well. And we see not necessarily a airbending guru, but a guru who studied with airbenders. I believe he said he did. He was a friend of Gyatso, so I assume he did.
Yeah, he said he was a spiritual brother of airbenders.
Yeah, so I guess we could consider him, like, the earliest acolyte. The original, the hipster acolyte.
The hipster.
Hipster. We also have karma, which I don't think was specifically mentioned in Avatar, but it's kind of there in some actions and things that Aang does and the airbenders do. I mean, the idea of not killing. But
yeah, I don't remember it specifically being quoted.
Yeah, it's not, but I think it's there in general.
I mean, based on the other influences, you could pick up on it.
Yeah. And then, of course, rebirth, reincarnation. I think we can take away the fact that they're vegetarian and the fact that the Avatar is reincarnated, that air nomads believe in reincarnation. And the Guru's words during the Crossroads of Destiny, or the episode of the Guru, that entire sequence, either way, where he says, you know, nothing dies, everything's reborn. Specifically, he was talking about love, but...
Because nothing ends. Talking about, like, you know, the elements as well, that everything's just linked together.
Yeah. So one thing I want to get into, maybe the more interesting part of this, I don't know, is the pros and cons of this lifestyle.
Can't eat any meat, man.
There's one con.
Thank you.
I mean, specifically in terms of maybe, like, detachment. Like, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Like,
yes.
Kind of makes you seem like a robot sometimes. Like, when Aang was trying to act really detached, when Appa was lost, he seemed just emotionless, and it was kind of weird.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, because the air avatar is basically brought up with all these other monks and kids, brought up to believe that they can be spiritually detached, and then Yang Chen comes along, and he's all like, no, the avatar can't do that, sorry. So, I mean, I don't know, I guess that might be a con. When it comes to attachment, because not everyone can do it.
It's hard for us to imagine, because we live in a material world, and none of us can imagine what they're trying to achieve spiritual enlightenment. You know, a nirvana, essentially, that we don't, I mean, we can't really, I mean, we can, you know, I would say that it would be hard for me to become detached with, you know, from family and things, but it's really hard, I guess, for us to really say on that note, particularly, because... I mean, it's just two entirely different things. Like, if one of us is Buddhist, maybe. But I don't think he is Buddhist.
I'm going to be devil's advocate slightly for this and say that, you know, maybe with this detached from detached emotions specifically. I mean, look at what Aang does when he's on an emotional high before he controlled the Avatar state. I mean, look at all the destruction he caused. I mean,
symbolism
of what?
I don't know. Of something, probably.
I mean, what then? You know, when he's
emotion
not...
is destructive,
right?
Well, that's just particularly with Aang. I mean, oh, I'm seeing the symbolism now, Sam. Good job.
I still don't get it. Could someone explain it?
Okay, this is we're talking about the Avatar is, like, he's the most powerful being, and so if he gets angry, he can't control his emotions, he's not detached, causes all this destruction. It's symbolic of a normal person who can't control their feelings, and you know, they can't become detached. So good job, Sam.
Okay,
okay, then let's not use the Avatar. Let's say, you know, because air nomads have this ability to bend, and when it's used for that purpose, it can be deadly. I mean, we saw Aang kill a buzzard wasp in the desert. I mean, is it better to be attached and not use that power to for revenge or for harm, or is it better to have emotion?
I think this connects a lot to the Jedi way and, like, the light versus the dark and how powerful it is when you're using the dark, but you just become corrupt.
You kind of need to find a middle ground, because the Sith are the extreme and the Jedi are the extreme as well. I mean, both sides of the spectrum there.
What's the extremes of airbending?
Well, we're talking about...
like a dim area in this light versus dark side.
Well, I would think Aang's in the middle, because he's not wholly attached. I mean, he's not like, I guess... I can't really think of a truly materialistic person in the Avatar series. I guess the closest person could be Asami, but you couldn't really say that. But then you have the airbenders, I suppose Pothic maybe, that's completely unattached, then you have someone who's just completely materialistic and worldly, and then you have Aang in the middle, who just, his only real attachment is with his friends and family. That's not really bad. I mean, he loves people.
Mm-hmm. I find all the airbenders and in Korra aren't really that emotionally attached. I mean, Tenzin doesn't strike me as one of those guys. Like, he can get pretty vicious with his airbending. Not like Aang in, like, season 1, and, I don't know, midway through season 2. Where he was, like, ducking and avoiding everything. Tenzin, like, he's going for it. And, in fact, now that I think about it, we didn't really see an air nomad who was like, detached. Because, Monk Gyatso, was he really that attached? I mean, was he really that detached from, like, the material stuff? Well, not even the material stuff, but just, like, his emotions and everything. Like, he seemed to... find a lot of joy in everything. I'm not really sure what you mean by, like, emotionally detached.
Well, what I mean by this is, like, not creating attachments to other people.
Okay, well, he definitely had an attachment to Aang. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, the council wanted to separate them because of it.
Yeah.
Like Obi-Wan and Anakin, not really.
Not, yeah.
Okay. Not sure, really, but real quick, sort of.
Oddly off topic.
But yeah, I mean...
Yeah, it doesn't, yeah...
I guess what it comes down to is the person. I mean, because I can see where you would need to be detached sometimes, where you would need to not let your emotions get in the way, and sometimes when it's better to have emotions and not, you know, be a robot. But I don't think, I mean, to me, it depends more on the person. And I think that's where there's a bit of a fault in the Air Nomad philosophy. I don't know if anyone agrees.
Well, yeah, that's what I was getting at with the middle. Agree, yeah. You gotta be in the middle.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
Can I bring up a point I was trying to bring up a little bit ago?
Go ahead.
Well, just you talked about the Air Nomad Elders, and I just wanted to draw that line to the Jedi Council.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the Jedi aren't meant to rule, they're meant to serve, but we have this little Council of Elders, you know, with Yoda and Mace Windu, and you have the Jedi Council, and who the Jedi come to, and just thought I'd bring that up, since there really are a lot of parallels between Avatar and the Jedi, and of course they draw from the same influences, so.
Yeah, I noticed that, too.
Alright, sweet.
Just like how the season 2 finale is essentially the Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, that's another
thing.
Yes. The Crossroads of Destiny is basically the Empire Strikes Back in every way.
Oh, I rewatched that. It's ridiculous.
If you watch that season finale, keep thinking about the Empire Strikes Back, you will never be able to unsee it, because everything is essentially the same exact thing. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
Do
it's
that.
Pretty crazy. I mean, I love it still, but...
Yeah, no, I'm not knocking it. Okay. I'm just saying it's ridiculous how similar... They probably incidentally made it. I mean, I don't think it was on purpose. but maybe it was.
Oh, I think it was on purpose.
You think so?
Well, I don't think you can just, like, there are obviously probably big fans, the obvious probably, okay, well, they're big, Mike and Brian, they're fans of Star Wars, like, you can tell, like, I know they draw from the same influences, but there's a certain line, also, how can you not be a fan of Star Wars, but that's a whole other thing, but I'm just saying, the similarities in Crossroads of Destiny were just uncanny. Like, I mean, at the end where Aang gets shot down by lightning, I saw that as Luke losing his hand.
Yeah, that's exactly how I viewed it as well. It was the synonymous with, well, not synonymous, but analogous to Aang, to Luke getting his hand chopped off by Vader.
I don't think it was just
Azula is his father.
Yes, Azula is his father.
Okay, it is now canon.
It was a plot line they cut out, but...
No, it's Aang, I am your grandfather.
Aang is her grandfather, yeah. So there you go, even more so. Aang is her grandfather.
Great-grandfather.
Her great-grandfather.
They need to talk about that more.
We need to have a conversation about that.
Family reunion.
But, so yeah, I mean, that's essentially what brought this on in the first place, is that Sam and I were talking, and we noticed, wow... Crossroads of Destiny is basically The Empire Strikes Back, and then from there it was like, wow, yeah. The Air Nomads are basically like Jedi Knights. So,
yep. Farbingers here.
So, yeah.
Oh, and then one more thing, and then Leia / Katara saves him. So,
yeah, catches him as he drops from the bottom. Oh,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, she catches him too. The same way that Leia catches.
And we land in the Pieta.
Yeah, and yeah, that's another thing.
Yeah, we were talking about that too.
Yeah, for another podcast, I'd like to get into that.
Art parallels in Avatar.
And then they go onto a flying device.
Yeah, like it's basically The Empire Strikes Back, guys. Go watch it. Yeah. You'll see.
Gonna have to now.
Like, pause it and watch it.
Yeah, pause this podcast, even though it's basically pretty much, I think, done by now. But pause it anyway.
Do it right now.
And go watch it and come back and listen to the last few minutes.
For nothing.
All right, sweet. Anything else to add, guys, to that discussion?
Wait, hold on. Just
no.
Okay. A big one. The Jedi believe in the Force, right? And that's basically the energy that like comes from like every living thing in the universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Avatar really has a parallel to that with. Well, in the swamp, I was gonna say the swamp where Aang like finds Apan Momo, and then in the Guru when the Guru Patik finds Aang. Wait, no, it wasn't in the Guru. That was in Appa's Lost Days, was it?
Yeah,
He can trace the energy, so it's like that everyone's connected. He even mentions that like the whole nation's a whole. So there's a big one right there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the binding energy that you know. Is connected to everything and everyone, like you said, you know, with the swamp, and you did mention the swamp, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the swamp and the Guru.
Maybe the Benders have midichlorians, too.
Yeah.
They do.
Solves the whole genetic thing.
That solves every genetic question.
Energy bending,
ever.
Blood bending, it's really just destroying midichlorians.
Yes.
There we go. Ellie will be happy.
Finally, an answer.
Yep, that's the reason that Amon was... taking people's bending away, he was destroying their midichlorians. It all
in
makes
the blood,
sense.
In the blood
midichlorian.
And then Korra restores them.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
This podcast
gives
requires a pretty fair knowledge of Star Wars.
Say that now.
Yeah, if you have gotten through it and do not understand, please go watch Star Wars and come
midichlorians
back.
Make you have again. The Force. They're the reason you can use the Force.
Yeah. It's a very interesting and in-depth thing. So just go watch the prequel series of Star Wars.
Yeah, go watch them.
Please,
Go watch them.
Not the other one.
And then come back and talk to us. Alright, so anything else, guys?
Well, I wanted to be really obvious with the Buddhist stuff, because I wrote this down, and they have shaved heads, like Buddhist monks.
Any reason in particular why? Does it say?
I don't really know a particular reason.
Okay.
I do.
They have beards. They have very luxurious beards. So maybe
like
that's Tenzin's, I don't know.
Tenzin's got a pretty luxurious beard.
Indeed. And they have similar robes, like the same colors.
Yeah, I noticed that too, because actually on my campus, I guess some Buddhist monks were visiting, and they were walking around in orange and yellow robes, and I was like,
You were like, there's airbenders on campus.
Guys, there's airbenders on campus. Why
are you guys cosplaying?
Yeah, is there a convention I don't know about? But yeah.
I was not invited.
So...
Oh, and the detached thing, the kids really don't seem to detach either, so you think they'd start them early? Well, I don't know how Aang learned all of that, because, like, Monk Gyatso, when he was young with Roku, I don't know, it's just, and when they're playing that air scooter game, like, what?
Well, Aang was, it's mentioned that he, I don't know if he was the youngest, but he was, you know, 12 years old when he mastered airbending, so.
Okay, well, that could explain some of it, but still, he wasn't too emotionally detached, as I've probably said before.
No, they were trying, really see, that's the thing, they were trying to make him emotionally detached, and he ran away from it, so.
Yeah, in like one episode.
I think that's the next part of mastery, like, after the 36 tiers and stuff, becoming detached.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the next stage of, well, I guess, well, like, technically your training's already finished, sort of. It's like when you get your black belt, your training's not really done, it's just kind of begun. Yeah, I guess
you,
I kind of see that.
You just continue onward and...
Yep.
Find your path.
Yeah, and find your path.
There you go.
Bolin's path.
I remember.
Yes, if anyone has seen Bolin's path, he's looking for it, so...
He's looking for you.
It's like that bank commercial.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I think we're about done here.
Are you going to do the ending song? I always wanted to know how that works.
I don't know.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I honestly... Okay.
No idea.
Okay.
How does that work?
That is all for this mini-cast.
Still an hesitant.
I have been your main host, Mel. My mini-hosts have been Sam, Ryan, Lim, and Delaney. This podcast is co-created and produced by Dylan. Dongbufeng is owned by Jake. And I forgot to mention this in the beginning, but email us at dylan@dongbufeng.net and post in the forums at dongbufeng.net/forums.
Dongbunet.
Alright. That's awesome. 15 seconds. Do we agree on something to end on?
Pie.
We shouldn't end on anything.
End on high.
Pie.
Okay, fine.
Pie.
Alright, fine, whatever.
Wait, what are we ending on?
Pie. Because it's an inside joke from the last minicast.
No, it's not fruit pie, then. You know, because the monks love fruit pies.
We're just doing pie, because it's easier. Alright, ready?
Could you please? Okay.
One, two, three.
Pie!
Pie.